You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, February 7th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. The literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Sarah Robinson, senior editor of the Visions page at alternet.org, on some new rules for radicals and some, visions of the future, a progressive, more leftist future. That and more on the program. The foreclosure deal, still breaking, soon to break. We will dig into that. Expecting also today in California, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is expected to release an opinion on the constitutionality of Proposition 8. This is you remember the Proposition 8. It was famously known as Proposition Hate, the 2008 ballot measure in California, basically saying that gay people don't have the same right to marry as straight people. This campaign heavily funded by the Mormon Church, incidentally. A three-judge panel heard arguments on whether the decision to strike down Proposition 8, you remember, Prop 8 was found unconstitutional. However, the judge apparently who ruled on it was gay. And so opponents felt like, well, he's not in a position to decide because he's gay. I wonder if this three-judge panel, when they come out with their ruling, if it comes out that these three judges were straight and they say that Proposition 8 is constitutional, if their decision will be subject to a challenge. It's very complicated because at that point you'd only be able to have. Well, what's the theory here? You need to not be impacted in any way. I mean, aren't most of these things, when we talk about constitutionality or something, most of these people, I would assume, who are judges, would also be citizens. I wonder if that sort of unfairly biases them towards any decisions that would affect citizens or human beings, for that matter. This could get very, very complicated. And I don't know if the logic is that, well, you cannot share anything in common with anybody who's affected by a ruling. But I mean, if we know that gay marriage leads to the destruction of the traditional marriage, you know, in terms of, well, forget about divorces and forget about adultery. That's not, then if these people are married,
This is going to be very complicated, ladies and gentlemen. But that ruling will come out later in the day. Lot to talk about in terms of the foreclosure fraud settlement, which we will get to after speaking to Sarah Robinson. Bo Biden was on Radigan yesterday before I came on. There's intrigue around this. There's just no doubt about it. Because no one I've talked to really has a sense of what's going on between Biden and Schneiderman, what game Schneiderman's playing. We heard from Bob Kuttner yesterday, his opinion on that. More info today. We will get to it. Also, the latest. Remember that trigger? The cuts, the trigger on the cuts from the debt deal? Well, that seems to be unraveling in a way that, may not be helpful for us. Of course, it may not be helpful either way. We'll get to that and more after we speak to Sarah Robinson. Be right back after. All right, folks, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Sarah Robinson. She is the senior editor of the just recently launched Visions page at alternet.org. And Sarah is also a trained social futurist. Of course, a former fellow at the Campaign for America's Future. And anybody who's read any blogs, liberal blogs online, have certainly read what you've written. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's good to be here.
All right. So, Sarah, let's start with this. I want to get to your piece about the new rules for radicals. But before we do, tell me a little bit about the Visions page at Alternet. What is the point behind this?
Okay, this is something that Alternate started about a year ago, but it was just sort of a quiet corner of things. There was no official editor. And so they brought me on to build it out. We're going to talk a lot about the progressive vision for the future, about places where that vision is already manifesting. You know, we get really kind of heads down, you know, with one foot in front of the other and not paying a lot of attention. And we get to having a lot of despair because we don't really understand that, yes, we have this really vibrant, strong vision of the world that we want to create, and we have a strong consensus around it. What we don't have are a lot of good examples of people who are living the vision, who are thinking ahead on it, who are building a bridge between here and there. There are successes around us. There are also places where that vision comes under threat from the right wing, and so my beat is going to be to cover a lot of that, just this whole emergent new progressive world that we're building.
I'm particularly interested in the idea of you know, what is the consensus, let's say, around an economic vision? Is there one really?
Right now, there's not. The consensus is emerging. There are a lot of very strong speakers about the idea of what comes next. I think we're pretty clear now that it is possible to remake capitalism. to work better for the people, that it's broken the way it works. Umair Haq has done some wonderful work on this. Garel Perovitz has done some. Jeffrey Sachs, Paul Hawken. There are a lot of people out there who have put forth new ways of doing capitalism that simply re-incentivize the way that the incentives flow, so that the money and the capital and the gains don't go to private parties, but rather flow back into the common good. So people make enough. You know, the workers are paid enough, the executives get enough and some to share, you know, they do all right. But we're not going to get this lopsided 1%, 99% thing that we've got going on. A lot of that money needs to be redirected to the larger common good. The workers need a lot bigger say in how companies are run. In Germany, for instance, unions have a seat on the board of corporations and a large say in how things unfold on the shop floor. And that's built right into the German system. And it's why German workers make 40% more than American ones do and aren't losing their jobs.
And they get 4 weeks worth of vacation.
That's frankly. Right. And 2 weeks plus 2 weeks of sick leave. Yeah, and they do all right.
I mean, in Germany, we see things like, they deal with unemployment with things like work share. And they're just, it seems so much more progressive, so much more forward thinking. And I guess the challenge is, if we have these notions out there, I mean, the solutions, at least the partial solutions exist, is the challenge getting from here to there? Is it, I mean, when you write about these new rules for radicals, when you're editing this, is the challenge tactical? Is it something that, is it political? Is the challenge is social? I mean, or maybe it's all of those things.
They're all those things. They're absolutely all those things. Change has to run on a lot of cylinders. And there are social changes. In fact, there are deep values changes. I'll be covering religion and values a lot on this page, because I think religion, or even epistemology, I back off from religion, but just the way we view the world, how we decide what we value, that drives culture, and culture drives politics, and politics drives economics. And so if you're going to change one thing, it's all an interlocking system, and you have to change, you know, on many, many fronts. Is it tactical? Yes, I think at this stage there are a lot of these fronts on which it is tactical, that we have a pretty good idea strategically of what we need to do. There are other fronts on which the strategy is still really lacking. Especially the kind of epistemological fronts. Progressives are really bad at getting down, and conservatives are very good at talking about what matters, about what our deep values are, and how our policies are extensions of those values. We've been very quick to abandon values and cede that field to the right wing, and I think that's been a terrible mistake.
Well, but why do you think that is?
Why do you think that we cede it? I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that to be progressive means that you are probably college educated, or you live at least in a very liberal and secular environment. And part of liberalism is we have a secular mindset. We think religion is a private matter, so we don't talk about it. We grant people their private space around it. And so we just don't go there. And conservatives are not afraid to go there. They're not afraid to say this is right and this is wrong because the Bible tells me so. Now, we will not go to because the Bible tells me so, although there are times in which it's probably appropriate to do that, you know, if you're a Christian progressive. But there are definitely times when this is right and this is wrong because the science tells us so, because, you know, whatever our scripture is, because nature tells us so. But we have to be very firm with people about saying that, yes, we do have a clear sense of right and wrong. The conservatives are not the only ones in possession of a conscience. And we've allowed them to hold on to that. And when people can do that, they get to control the vision. They get a big voice in how the future unfolds. And so this is one of the things, of course, I'll be talking about on the page.
When you say like progressives are college educated, I mean, isn't that perhaps maybe part of the problem? I mean, you know, the idea. I mean, I'm not even sure I agree necessarily with that statement, but I'm not. What do you mean by that? I mean,
funny you should ask, because my column this week, actually, I've got one I'm writing later in the week that's going to be about this very thing, about the habits of mind that we learn in college. For instance, we learn in college not to steal ideas. And in fact, this is one of my rules for radicals. We learn that it's plagiarism and we have to be original. When we speak up in class, we need to have an original idea. When we write a paper, we have to have original thoughts. And we're penalized if we're caught parroting other people's, our classmates, or something we read in a book. So, but out in the world, one of the things that really works in politics, if you're going to drive home an idea, is repetition. You have to be willing to get out there and repeat the same thing over and over and over for 25 years if necessary in order to get the mass of Americans to hear and understand it. Repetition is a really important communication tool in politics. So that's, for instance, one of the things.
So you're talking more about activists.
Activists, right. Another one is that we tend to try to persuade with facts. Because in a classroom, if you try to persuade with, this is what I feel, this is what my religion tells me, this is what my moral code is, those kinds of persuasions do not fly in a college classroom. And rightly so. I mean, they're trying to teach us to reason. It turns out the American public at large, when you're trying to communicate political ideas, is not highly impressed by reason and is highly impressed by your passion and conviction. So there's another lesson.
I'm a little bit confused here because I get your characterization of the messaging system on the left in progressive circles, at least within the context of sort of the activist class, makes sense to me. But I just don't, it seems to me that the problem may be that we don't have activists who are not going to college. Because on the right they have activists who go to college. It just seems to me that they're frankly that the people who rise within the if we're talking about the limited scope of activists and pundits and bloggers and whatever that world is, podcasters.
Yeah.
Radio hosts. If we're talking about that world, I think on the left, it's quite clear to me anyways, that remuneration does not come in the form of money in the way it does on the right. If you graduate from college on the right and you want to go into this field, this if you're an activist, the opportunities for you to write to do radio, to blog, and to get money for it is simply far greater than on the left. And I think the compensation on the left far too often comes from peer respect, from the compensation comes in the form of reputation and intellectual soundness, et cetera, which is problematic within the activist world because, like you say, the marketplace rewards these other factors, repeating things, not necessarily being original, frankly, on the right, not even being sound in many respects.
That's true. The other thing that the right wing has, and this is also related to the money, is that they're pundits who are caught at a very early age. You know, usually they're picked out in college and supported to hold on to their conservative views. A lot of people are conservative in college and move out of that as they get into the real world and see how things work. But a lot of conservative pundits started out in college and were the heads of the campus newspaper and then went right from there into trainings and think tanks. And they've spent their whole careers being groomed and very well paid to hold those views. But furthermore, they are also, because the conservatives are the party of business, they have access to these world-class, PR is too kind a word. I mean, there's PR and marketing firms that are deep, deep in the weeds on social psychology, who really, and cognitive, how to do cognitive science. And they really understand how people think. And the Republicans pay these people outrageous amounts of money to figure out how best to present their ideas. And then they train up these little paid soldiers to parrot these things. So these kids have got first-rate training from the world's best mass market influencers. So they've got that money creates an infrastructure for if you're talking about pitching ideas out into the great mass of Americans, they've got the machine in place. It's the machine that was honed by corporations selling us soap. So they have all of that infrastructure on their side that we simply don't on our side. We've been trying to replicate it, but we simply don't have the kind of money that pays some firm $25 million to figure out how to sell us on low taxes.
And so, so the response to that challenge is to change what we do in terms of messaging, or is it to perhaps broaden or change the notion of activism? I mean, you speak in you speak your first rule of the new rules for radicals is that the world is different now. The rules have changed, and you cite Occupy. How have they changed, and in what ways?
Well, one of the realities, unfortunately, about that kind of brand building, you know, that you can, the conservatives or corporations spends a lot of money to build a brand. And as we've seen with Susan G. Komen in just the last couple of weeks, a brand can fall apart very quickly. One that's been well constructed over 30 years can collapse in a week if something bad goes amiss. And what Occupy did, bless their hearts, was the conservative brand, which we all knew the country was having trouble with, collapsed. Basically, you know, Occupy put up this frame of the 99% versus the 1%, and they got out there, and all the conservative arguments, the worldview that they carefully constructed for 30 years, just imploded, because that doesn't reflect the reality that most people are living. And when Occupy said it's 99% of us against the 1%, 70% of Americans said, "Yep, that's right." And so the whole conservative worldview that they've been so successful with is no longer saleable. And we're watching Mitt Romney flounder because of it, because he stands for everything that party stands for. And Americans are looking at that and saying, no, that's not what we stand for anymore. And so that was a huge opening that changed everything. And so that's exciting to me, that because we have this new political moment in which nobody knows what's going to work. The rules have completely changed, and Occupy was able to get traction because of that.
But isn't also there seems to me there's even a larger change in my estimation that Occupy has ushered in, is that the measure of that the goals, at least in terms of changing politics or structure, I should say the short-term strategic or even the tactical goals in making that change are perhaps different than we have been different than the ideas that we've been operating under. In other words, mm-hmm. It's one thing to change the narrative, but it's also we're seeing something fundamentally different. I don't know that that Occupy started out with the idea that we're going to change the narrative. They started out by saying there's simply real anger here towards what's going on. And, you know, the message then resonated out from them. But I can't help but think that the change is larger, that it's a that the lesson there is one of almost less engagement in the traditional narrative and more focusing on the strength that we have in letting the chips fall where they may.
Well, this kind of moves on to my third rule, which is try everything, because we are in this brand new landscape where things that have not worked. I mean, how many demonstrations in the last 20 years I can name maybe four or five that have actually changed the narrative on anything. Before the Iraq War, we had 15 million people in the streets and it did nothing. The media ignored us. So we've gotten used to the idea that demonstrations don't work, but Occupy worked, okay? So now we are in a really new space, which means that there are a lot of things that we've tried and failed and tried and failed. We know we've walked away from because we think they don't work, that may now work. We don't know what the new rules are in this environment, and we're not going to know until we start pushing the edges of the envelope and just start throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks. So that's my third rule, is just try everything, because the rules have changed and you don't know.
And we just have time. Hit one. You've got another, obviously, seven new rules. But which one do you think is beyond those two that we've discussed is perhaps the most important?
I'm really fond of focus on our goals, not on our enemies. And this is a hard one for me because as a blogger, I made my bones talking about the right wing and all the dastardly ways they're trying to hamstring us. And the problem is that fighting the right, defeating the right, is not the war. The battle that we are in is to manifest our progressive vision of the world to come. All right, we have a very different idea of what America can be, a positive one that a lot of Americans are ready to sign on to. And our goal is to have that America. All the conservatives are to us is in the way, and all the energy they deserve is however much it takes to get them out of the way. Okay, we have to understand them and their strategy and their tactics and analyze them, but we can't get excited, we can't get upset, we can't spend all of our time fretting about them. All they are is in the way. Stay focused on the far horizon. So that's the other one that I think is really important, is don't give the right any more energy than they're entitled to. They're entitled to some, but they're not entitled to all of it, and beating them is not the war.
Do you think the paradigm is just about right and left at this point? I mean, where does the idea of, I mean, because at the end of the day, I agree with this notion that we shouldn't focus too much on the right, and to the extent that I talk about the Republicans or right wingers, it's really part of the entertainment value at this point. But where does just money come into this? The moneyed, because we have, I think, one of the real bigger problems that I think faces people who are looking for to create a more just form of capitalism is not simply on the right, but the sense that, you know, we have liberals who are also sort of quite happy with the structure of our capitalism. I mean, it's one thing to say that we need to tax millionaires more, but there's a more fundamental underlying problem that's creating things like income disparity, which is often a bridge too far to go with at least nominal liberals. I mean, up until the recent rhetoric, one could point to perhaps the Obama administration as an example of this.
I think I've got a piece going up today at Alternet, right on the page. Alternet, you know, I go up to Alternet and click on the visions thing and you'll see it. That talks a little bit about this. I think that the battle right now is not even right versus left. I think that the battle is between an old, dying America, a vision of America that was the post-war manufacturing, runs on oil, everybody has cars, this, you know, free market capitalist sort of model that we've been running on since World War II. I think that world is passing. And I think, there are people in both parties who are partisans of that old future, who are trying to keep it alive, who think we're going to go back to normal. You know, we're looking forward to the economy going back to normal. And what I argue today is that back to normal is not an option, because we are in a deep structural phase shift, the kind we only ever have about every 80 years. Joe Stiglitz agrees with me, by the way, and so does Jeffrey Sachs, and so do a lot of people, that we have, there's a foundational shift in the nature of our economy happening, and you have, almost every conflict that you see, economic, political, cultural, is an artifact of this fact that you've got an old America that's passing away and a new one that's struggling to be born. And the only question is, which side of that fight are you on? And I think as progressives, most of us are trying very, we see that clearly, the vision of the next America, and we're trying very hard, the one that's sustainable, the one that doesn't run on oil, the one that has good transit, the one that has a strong middle class, the one that has a mix of farming and manufacturing, the one where the 99% does not own, owns, you know, more, you know, their fair share and more of the economy. Those, you know, that's the America we're working for. And there are all kinds of reasons that the old one is structurally unstable. It's falling apart. It cannot sustain itself, and time is on our side. But that, I think, is the fundamental split, really.
I agree, and it's fascinating stuff. And we'll link over to the Visions page over at Alternet. Sarah Robinson, thank you so much for joining us. Very interesting stuff.
Hey, Sam, it was fun.
Okay. We got to take a break, folks. We'll be back in just a minute and give you an update on these foreclosure settlements. I mean, again, you know, the reason why I focus on this so much at this point is because this is where, if there's any movement that's going to take place over the course of the next 9 months, before 10 months, before the elections, this is where it's going to be. And at the end of the day, if we're going to fundamentally change the way our financial system, or at least the aspect of finance having so little social utility in our country, other than to enrich the financiers, some of them are going to have to take a walk. And that walk is going to have to be from their office or their mansion or their Bentley into the police station so they can get fingerprinted. And hopefully we're going to see some of that. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back after this. All right, folks, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. With all this stuff going down in Syria, oh, I should also tell you, this is a great time to tell you, become a member of the Majority Report. Become a member of the Majority Report. What will you allow us to do with your membership? One, you will allow us to get a, what is that thing called? The gate and a processor. It's a piece of equipment that we're going to buy that is going to level out and help the quality of our audio. What else will you do? You'll allow us to hire someone to start cutting a best of on the weekends from the incredible amount of material, high quality material that we present to you during the week. What will that do? Well, that will expand the universe of those people who will be getting this content, and it will help maybe change things in this country, perhaps. And maybe it won't. But maybe when you wear that T-shirt around, that Majority Report T-shirt, people will go like, I listened to that show. And then socially, you'll feel more comfortable because people will like you.
And maybe Sam will finally be able to stop docking me from all these people leaving because of me.
That I cannot guarantee will happen. That I cannot guarantee will happen. So I'm not going to make promises I can't keep. That could be a bridge too far. Okay, so as of yesterday, the deadline for all of the attorney generals in the country to sign on to this federally orchestrated mortgage deal with the biggest banks in the country had passed. Yesterday on Dylan Radigan, Bo Biden, the attorney general from Delaware, and this may seem petty, but I'm always, like, I'm watching him. He is incredibly clear as to where he stands on this deal. He will not sign on to it. He is also, if not totally explicit, fairly explicit, that he thinks the feds have not done a very good job in pursuing the people who destroyed our economy. His father is fairly well placed in the federal government as vice president. And I'm just fascinated at the idea of, like, and they seem very close too. They, you know, there's no stories of them being estranged in any way. I just wonder if, you know, somebody in the White House says, hey, you know, all this work we're doing with Sean Donovan at HUD, trying to get everybody on board, your son is one of the biggest problems we have. Any chance you might call him? I don't know. I'm fascinated by that, but that's really neither here nor there. So Bo Biden goes on yesterday and he says, I'm not signing on to this deal because it precludes me it precludes me from investigating things like MERS. MERS, we've mentioned many times. It's on the, it's the mortgage electronic registry system. It was set up to bypass the literally hundreds of years of law and common law, which require you to really be explicit when you transfer for property, land, because of problems in the past with people just coming and saying, no, this is my land. And what that led to was this rash of ongoing of robo-signing and fraudulent signing. People signing saying, this is an affidavit saying that we really do own this material, and I have seen the actual documents that show it, even though it all passed through MERS or some other similarly constructed system. So he says he's not going to sign on to this. When I saw Bo Biden on Radigan last week, he refused to mention the name of Eric Schneiderman, but mention Mastow from Nevada, Coakley from Massachusetts, Kamala Harris from California, the other holdouts. But Schneiderman had just joined this federal task force. Now, yesterday on the program, Bob Kuttner told us Schneiderman and Beau Biden, what was the phrase he used? They're working hand in glove. And it was unclear. Now, yesterday, eventually he did mention Schneiderman and sort of credited some of the work he was doing. And I was talking to Radigan, and Radigan was like, what's Schneiderman doing? And I said, I don't know. You know, Bob Kuttner says he knows what he's doing. I've talked to people who say that he knows what he's doing. And I can't imagine that he's going to give up this lawsuit. He just filed it Friday. Originally, the deal, as reported, because we don't know what the deal is for sure, had a carve-out for Schneiderman's deal. But the deal purportedly would have required Coakley and Mastow, who have similar, though not exact, lawsuits against these major banks, to essentially shut down their cases. Well, now it appears that the banks have freaked out about Schneiderman's deal, lawsuit, want the deal to include not have a carve-out for Schneiderman's lawsuit. And this may very well scuttle the deal. This morning, just about an hour ago, David Dayen reported that BOFA, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Wells Fargo made a last-minute demand that New York drop claims filed against them on February 3rd. I think this is from Bloomberg, as a condition of the settlement. Now, there's no way Schneiderman's going to back off a lawsuit that he's filed on Friday without having any political ambitions for the future. I just don't believe it. And so it appears like this deal may not go through. As of now, you still don't have at least these five attorney generals signed on to this deal. And the belief is if you don't have New York and California, this gives a lot of cover for a lot of other AGs not to sign on. And to a large extent, it's almost irrelevant. Because with New York, California, Delaware, and Nevada, you've got the basically one of the ground zeros of this stuff. I mean, aside probably from Florida. And now it's reported in New York Times that a Missouri grand jury, and presumably these charges were brought by Attorney General, has come out with an indictment against a company called DocX, of accusing DocX of 136 counts of forgery in preparation of documents used essentially to foreclose on homeowners. Lorraine Brown, the company's founder and former president, was indicted on the same charges. Employees of DocX, a unit of Lender Processing Services of Jacksonville, Florida. That LPS is essentially another version of MERS. Executed and notarized millions of mortgage documents for big banks and loan services over the years. Lender Processing closed the company in April 2010 after evidence emerged of apparent forgeries in these documents, which we now know as robo-signing. The Missouri grand jury found that the person whose name appeared on 68 documents executed on behalf of a lender, someone named Linda Green, did not exist and was not the person who signed the documents. A recent civil lawsuit against Lender Processing by the Attorney General of Nevada, this is Mastow's case, found that former workers at one of its divisions had described their work as, quote, surrogate signers. That's a polite way of saying forgers. One worker who was quoted in the complaint said she'd been paid $11 an hour and told that her job was to, quote, sign somebody else's signatures on documents. The person, she said, had signed roughly 2,000 documents a day for months. And apparently this robo-signing still going on across the country. So what we may be seeing, and again, this has been the question we've been asking for 2 weeks since President Obama announced this and announced Eric Schneiderman to co-chair the federal task force on foreclosures. That Schneiderman took this job, they just assumed he would drop his other pursuits, assumed he would sign on, and now basically he's telling him no. I mean, it could be one of those situations where it's just like the feds just keep calling Schneiderman, and it's just like, oh no, he stepped away from his desk. No, he's busy right now. He's on the squash courts. So it's fascinating stuff, and we will know more as the day goes on as to whether or not this deal collapses or doesn't, or whether they end up extending the deadline. We just don't know. Coming up in the better half of the program, I will talk about that trigger deal. You've forgotten all about it. Remember that debt deal where if the super committee could not come to an agreement on how to screw over Social Security pensioners and Medicare recipients, then there would be a 50-50 cut between defense spending and discretionary spending. And, of course, that discretionary spending would be on top of caps already put on the budget. In other words, devastating cuts. All good and well to cut defense, but we'll talk more about the implications in the better half of the program, what's happening with that. Anonymous strikes again. This time, Syrian President Assad, his top advisors, have their emails hacked. And the Senate, at least half of the Senate Democrats, sell out unions again. We'll talk about that story in the better half of the program. That and your phone calls at 646-257-3920, your IMs at Majority FM. You can support this program, ladies and gentlemen. If you buy junk through Amazon, buy it through our link at majority.fm, support the show. Apparently Valentine's is coming up. You may want to get on that. JustCoffee.coop, 10% discount with the coupon code MAJORITY. Coffee, tea, chocolate, fair trade, makes a great, great Valentine's gift. Delicious chocolate. That can be, it's guilt-free because people get paid fairly to whatever they do with chocolate. Jog? Oh, pick. Okay. All right, folks, see you in the better half.